Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks very much for joining us today. So I just finished talking with Sarah Allen about her really fantastic new book, Shifting Stories: History, Gossip, and Lore in Narratives from Tang Dynasty China. This came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2014. And it's a book that I think is going to be of wide interest both to readers and listeners of this podcast who are interested in Chinese literature, in the history of China, the history of the Tang Dynasty, the history of storytelling and tales of the strange within that context, but also for listeners and readers who perhaps don't have a pre-existing interest in or expertise in China, but who are interested in the history of the relationship between ideas of fact and fiction, of history and literature, of notions of authorship and textuality, and specifically of the non-human and the idea of things that talk and tell stories. So it's a really wide-ranging and really totally fascinating text. And what you'll hear us talk about over the course of the conversation are both some of the major arguments and major points that Sarah's making in these chapters, but also some of the many, 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 many really awesome stories that she describes and translates for us in the course of the analysis. So it was a lot of fun to talk with her about this. It was a lot of fun to read through these stories, and it was a really enlightening book as well. So thanks very much for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Sarah Allen about her new book, Shifting Stories. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. Sarah, thanks for making time to talk with me today, and thanks for a super fascinating book. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks very much, Carla. Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, could you start us off, as is traditional for the channel, by saying a little bit about what brought you to the field you work in, and specifically, how did you come to work in Chinese literature and to work on the Tang Dynasty in particular?
Well, I would say that getting into the field in general was in many ways serendipitous. I started Chinese to fulfill a college language requirement, sort of thought, oh, that will be, you know, more interesting than Spanish or French. Having really no idea what I was getting myself into. But I did stick with it and really enjoyed literary Chinese as a language when I started that. I think, you know, probably in part because I wasn't expected to try to speak it. It was, you know, sort of nicely there on the page. But, you know, the elegance and the conciseness of the language really appealed to me, and sort of the problem-solving aspect of realizing that these, texts or words that were by no means transparent to me were nonetheless, the product of someone speaking, someone trying to say something. The intellectual deciphering process, got me interested in literary Chinese or classical Chinese language texts in general, in the Tang in particular. I'm not sure if it was the Tang as a period so much as, you know, I'd always enjoyed reading stories, and so was sort of drawn to this. As I started reading initially in translation, Tang tales, I was sort of, I was just interested in them. I liked the material.
Mm-hmm. So was that pretty much what brought you to the focus on Tang tales in particular? So we're, for listeners, the book itself, and you'll hear much more about this over the next hour, focuses on the literature of tales in the 8th and the 9th centuries. So Sarah, was it a kind of inherent just interest and love for these tales that brought you to it? And if in either case, how did you come to decide to write a book about these?
Yeah, I think, why this material in particular, first and foremost, it is such fun and rich material to read. And so, you know, I enjoyed reading it. But I think also, you know, the more I did read, the clearer it was to me that sort of the standard story that's told about these tales that is, you know, to a large extent based on just a few select tales was really not adequate to, in explaining the material as I saw it. And so I started reading even more. But yeah, I would definitely say that the book itself was really material driven rather than idea driven. You know, it was less that I had a theory that I wanted to test or prove than that I was intrigued by the texts and, you know, the disconnect between what I had read and learned about them and then what I saw in the material itself and the tales themselves. And so, I was very much motivated by, just the desire to answer the question, well, you know, what is this material? Where does it come from? Why has it been preserved? More than kind of coming to it with an idea about it that I wanted to explore.
Great. And one of the really wonderful things about the book, I think, is how much you're giving us in the book, translations from introductions to and excerpts from the tales themselves. So we're talking about some really fascinating literature on, court intrigue, on fox women, on ghosts, on weddings, at which the guests are historical figures or mythological figures. There's all kinds of riddling tales in here. There are objects that talk. So it's inherently a really fascinating set of materials. And one of the things I really loved about the book was how much the translations and descriptions of the tales really bring us into and give us a sense of the texture of these materials.
No, thanks. Yeah, no. I mean, you're right. Just the sheer richness of what's out there, I think, is just just amazing. I mean, really, kept my interest.
Absolutely.
Work with.
So this is a project that started off, at least in some form, right, in some way, as a dissertation that then transformed into the book that we see here. So can you talk a little bit about that process? Were there any kind of major changes from dissertation to book or, in any other form, significant, if not major changes, either in how you were shaping and writing the book or in how you were conceptualizing the project as a whole?
I would say that the book is really substantially different from the dissertation, in part just because the dissertation was based on a much more limited set of material in which, I would say I started working towards some of the ideas that got developed more in the book, but hadn't really, I think, come to a lot of the understanding that I developed in the course of writing the book. And so I think that the dissertation is structured just much more on the idea of, of variation, and that there's, that there's a lot of fluidity in this material, sort of both on a textual level and sort of a narrative level, that you have different stories told in different ways, which comes into the, which very much informs the book, that the notion of these different the retelling of stories is a big part of the book itself. But I think I didn't have since it was based on such a much more limited set of materials, I didn't yet have clear a concept of really what was in there in terms of in the surviving corpus and how things related to each other. So I would say that most of what's in the book wasn't in the dissertation. There's one chapter of the dissertation that becomes a couple of chapters in the book, and conversely, much of what's in the dissertation didn't get into the book in terms of like looking much more closely at sort of textual variants, like word by word variants and the significance of that, or looking at, in the dissertation I also look at much more at Song Dynasty sort of selections from the Tang material and what happens to it in the Song and how Song readers seem to have used it. So that stuff that maybe I'll get back to it someday, but didn't find a place in the book as it was finally developed.
So the book itself starts with an introduction that brings us into the story. So as you tell us in the introduction, there was a fad for telling and collecting stories about remarkable events in 9th century China. Now, the book explores the kind of large-scale and smaller-scale variations in the tellings and retellings of the tales that you're looking at in the way a given set of events, as you put it in the introduction, or a given narrative formula. And we'll talk about both of those kind of instantiations of a tale, right, as a retelling of events or a telling of a, according to a particular formula, how these events or formula were used in different tales, both in tales that circulated individually and those that circulated in collections. And the introduction really, I think, very nicely lays out the importance of understanding the difference between kind of individual versus collective circulation of these tales. Now, you talk in the introduction about the importance of one of these collections. This is a late 10th century compendium, the Taiping Guangji. So can you maybe start us off by talking a little bit about that? For listeners who don't know anything about this literature, right, what is the Taiping Guangji and what's the significance of that for the larger story that you're going to be telling in this book?
Taiping Guangji was, it's an imperially sponsored compilation of anecdotal material from all periods up until the time when it was compiled, which was in the late 10th century in the 980s. And it, you know, what it does is it organizes topically all sorts of information about about strange stuff that doesn't have a place in other kind of more canonical compilations. So it was put together in conjunction with Wen Yin Yinghua, which is sort of belletristic writing, poetry, and more formal essays, and then also the Taiping Yulan, which is information that's supposed to be particularly useful to the emperor in his ruling. And then Taiping Guangji became the repository for other stuff. And most of this other stuff is anecdotal material about either kind of the occult, strange things that can happen contiguous worlds that are always around the human world, but that we don't always have access to, but that we might suddenly have access to. So, you know, things like ghosts and gods and immortals and things that can transform themselves, and also, you know, the powers of Taoist or Buddhist monks and wonder workers, or the things that have to do with that don't strictly have to do with our own human world. And so Taiping Guangji, you know, over the centuries, starting maybe in the third or fourth century, continuing throughout the imperial period, but in terms of what Taiping Guangji itself collects, certainly up through the five dynasties and early Song, that these are collections of materials that people people wrote down anecdotes that they heard about this material, collected them in some cases, for philosophical reasons or religious reasons to demonstrate that these you know strange things actually happened, to present this stuff as evidence of either the occult in general or of the power of Buddhist teachings or the power of Taoist teachings and Taoist belief, or on the other hand, sometimes some people seem to collect this stuff just purely out of interest, not necessarily with the out of a desire to proselytize, to make a point in the same way, but simply because it was interesting. And what Taiping Guangji does is it shifts through, what the editors of Taiping Guangji did is to sift through, volumes and volumes and volumes of this stuff accumulated over centuries and to organize it according to different categories. So, all of the things about water gods would go into one chapter. All of the things about Buddhist monks would go, or not just one chapter, a set of chapters. All of the things about foxes that can take on human guise would go into, in one place within the anthology. So it sort of becomes, in a sense, an anthology, or sorry, an encyclopedia of information, but an encyclopedia that doesn't compile information so much as reiterate or re-inscribe the information that has been collected by previous writers.
Great. And this is actually a source of some of the tales that you're going to go on to explore later on in the book.
Right. Yeah. So that's worth saying, actually, that it's so a lot of the material that I deal with is not preserved independently and becomes part of we have it only because Taiping Guangji preserved it, and it seems in many cases probably didn't preserve it fully, but more than any other sources did.
Great. And so what we're going to wind up, thank you so much. So what we're going to wind up hearing more about and talking more about and reading more about as we get further in the book is a kind of argument that fidelity to an original source wasn't really an important part of what was going on for most of the story anyway. So it's actually, as we think about the process of kind of collection and transformation that brings these Tang tales to the Taiping Guangji and then that brings you to the Taiping Guangji as a way of accessing it, it actually becomes, the process of accessing the tales through this collection becomes a really interesting part of one of the larger arguments of the book, and I think a way that works really, really well. So once we move from the introduction to the first chapter, we move into the sort of world of telling stories. So the first chapter looks at the importance of situating Tang tales in the context of social story exchange among elite men. Now, written tales and the practice of writing grew up, as you say, as you tell us about in this first chapter, out of gossip and hearsay that circulated among these elite men. So as a way to bring us into this part of the book, can you talk a little bit about this notion of gossip and hearsay as it animates what's happening here? What for you is really important for us to understand about gossip and hearsay in order for us to understand what's happening in this chapter of the book?
Well, I think that the this has a lot to do with sort of how the tales, this material has been treated in earlier scholarship, which has very much focused on a small subset of really sort of the most artfully written tales and how they and treated them as sort of authored works, analogous to fictional stories. What I think is what became clear to me as I read more and more of this material is that's not the full story here, and that the material seems much more to come out of a body of hearsay and lore and gossip that was circulating, initially orally, that people would and so these are the stories of the educated elite men who are for one thing have the ability to write these things down, but who are sort of who have been brought up to be literate and many of whom participate in or aspire to participate in the government bureaucracy, but that these are in many cases, the, you know, it seems to be the stories that they would tell each other on their in their time off, that you know, Tang elite men, you know, especially those in office, spent a lot of time traveling around, and so, you know, they would congregate at inns. They would go periodically back to the capital city of Chang'an, where they would meet again with old friends, and, you know, others in their social circles. And it, you know, it seems that one of the things that they would spend a lot of time doing would be just, you know, telling each other stories, entertaining each other, in some cases competing to sort of tell the most interesting or the best or the most shocking story. And, you know, so they seem to have told stories about a variety of things. And, you know, one aspect of that, not surprisingly, would have been, you know, gossip about their fellows. Did you hear that, you know, that so-and-so, that, you know, Li got sacked by the emperor because the emperor was angry for how he reprimanded him. You know, did you hear that that Wang was, you know, he met a beautiful woman the other day, but it turned out that she was in fact a turtle. And, you know, these are sort of the kinds of, in the sense of being gossip, you know, it's information about the people that, you know, about the people within their community, people that they would have either, whether they knew them directly or whether, you know, oh, as everybody's heard of the emperor's current favorite minister, you know, I've never met him, but this is the latest gossip about him. And so, you know, I see the written tales that we have that survive today is very much a product of that kind of storytelling practice. A product that, you know, in its written version, many of them are probably very, very different from, you know, that gossip as it would have been exchanged, you know, late one night at the inn, on the road to Luoyang or something like that. But that the that, you know, fundamentally, the written material that we have today kind of grows out of this social exchange of stories. Many of them, again, stories that would have you know, been about members of the same community that the storytellers themselves participated in.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And the chapter makes the point, I think, really importantly and really well, as we were talking a little bit about before, that fidelity to the source of the tale was not really particularly important here, right? Instead, the tales became a kind of origin point for men to develop their own tales. And the book talks about the importance of understanding this, or in the chapter, chapter one in the introduction in particular, talk about the importance of understanding this in the context of the relationship between tales and fiction. So this becomes really important to understand. And so listeners with a particular interest in how to understand what's happening in these tales within a larger sort of framework of discussions and debates over fiction and historicity might find special or material of special interest in chapter one, and indeed in chapter two. So chapter two kind of explores some of these same issues, but by looking at tales that relate gossip about public figures. So this chapter looks specifically about tales about Tang emperors, rulers, high officials who were interesting to the people who would have been telling these tales, right? And these tales, as you show, become vehicles for the discussion and debate of popular events. Now, one of the really interesting things for me that's happening in this chapter is the way you're relating, again, these tales to a larger frame of how we understand history, who gets to write history, how history is produced, what counts as history, and where we can look to find historical retellings of events. So for you, I just kind of want to open this up and hit the ball back to you. What for you is the most important aspect of how we understand these stories in chapter two, in terms of how we understand how to relate what's going on in these tales to history?
Well, I think that you know, one thing that's important here is, you know, realizing that many of these stories or these written tales, again, that we have, that we as 21st century readers, or really, you know, as post-Tang readers, read as sort of as narratives in their own right. I mean, narratives whose interest lies in the fact that in the narrative, in the story that they're telling, and to realize that many of these stories really are about traceable historical figures, and therefore that what then you know ties very closely again to the notion of these stories as gossip is that what these stories very much were trying to do in their time perhaps is to help readers understand recent events and form opinions about them so that they're about again, you know, my example of you know, so and so who was recently sacked by the emperor, who was offended by, you know, who he offended somehow, that the stories then give us a context for understanding what has happened. Well, give readers at the time a context for understanding, you know, events happening around them that they may have imperfect access to. So, you know, if we think about the way that information about, you know, what's happening in the central government or what, you know, what's happening in government anyway, and, you know, that, as you said, this is sort of what I focus on in this particular chapter, that, you know, people's access to that information could conceivably, you know, in many cases would have been quite quite limited, but at the same time, you know, it would be information that they would, you know, be of keen interest to them, and that the way that that these tales function there then is in, you know, that writers are really offering evaluations of recent events and of public figures and trying to influence their readers' understanding of these events and these figures. And, you know, and I think that in terms of our reading of history, what it does is to, you know, our reading of history in the present, what it does is to really remind us that when we are looking at the way that a set of historical events or a historical personage is presented in sort of canonical sources, that is, you know, that's one version of how a particular person was perceived, and that there may have been other opinions. So not to say that, like, the canonical sources are wrong necessarily, but that this kind of assessment of personality and assessment of a person's impact or of the significance of a certain event would have been something that at the time was very hotly contested. And, you know, different perspectives would give you different, or people standing in different perspectives would have very different interpretations of a certain, you know, personality or a certain sequence of events, and it might be, you know, that only one of those sort of wins out at the end and becomes the version that gets inscribed in history. And I think, you know, so just as if we're looking at political events today, you know, people on different sides of the political spectrum have very, very different evaluations of, you know, of any number of different political figures or events. But I think in terms of, you know, understanding, again, this material as a whole, that the recognizing this link to historical people is very important because it really reframes the way that we have to look at these stories, that it's not just, you know, a made-up entertainment about a figure who's given a certain name, but rather that these stories are imputing, you know, certain actions and certain feelings and certain thoughts to specific historical people, which doesn't mean that the stories themselves might not be all, in fact be made up, both made up and entertaining, but that they're not, that their original context is much, much broader because of that link to a historical person.
Thank you so much. And again, for listeners who are particularly interested in history, right, and sort of how we think about and how we practice history, I think this chapter is especially interesting because it really does help transform what we can think of as the archive of documentary traces for understanding a historical event by really expanding into a kind of text and a kind of tale that may not obviously seem to be historical, right? And in the same way that readers expect or understand. And you're really showing here that these tales led them or led readers to understand events in a particular way, created the knowledge about historical events. And they did so, as you've talked about, right, in a number of different ways, like either by countering prevailing versions of events, by filling gaps in historical knowledge. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on here and a lot of fabulous stories and tales that we won't have time to get into, but that I'll mark for listeners. So there's a lot of really, really cool descriptions and very interesting and intricate readings of tales that fit these particular categories that you're talking about. So as we move into chapters 3 and 4, we move into a very really fascinating discussion of a particular situation that shaped many of the tales that you're talking about. And this is a situation in which there's a lone male traveler. He encounters a stranger that has some sort of secret. So chapter 3 introduces what you call this adventure formula that makes up these tales of strange encounters. So at its most basic level, and I'll just kind of describe this formula for listeners so that we can kind of talk about some of the details. At its most basic level, there are two actors, though there could be much more. There's a human traveler, which is often a man, and there's a stranger, and there's four central actions. The first action is the traveler's encounter with the stranger. Then you have the traveler's interaction with the stranger. Then you have a parting from the stranger, and then there's a revelation that the stranger was not what she or he had seemed. Often the stranger is a she, but not always. Okay, so the chapter takes us into a bunch of really awesome tales that do a couple of different things. A group of the tales illustrate the kind of range of this formal model. So there's this one model that I've just described, but there's a lot of different ways that that can be used in these tales. And the chapter also takes us into five tales that kind of tweak to this model in order to explore often assumptions between the barrier between human and non-human, right? Between like the traveler who's often a human and the stranger who's often either a non-human or like oddly human in some way. Okay, so I'm going to basically just kind of open this up. For you, in the range of kinds of, or in the range of versions of these tales that follow this kind of model, do you have a particular favorite? And if you do, or if there's one that strikes you that's particularly interesting or important, could you introduce it for listeners and kind of maybe talk about, use it to maybe talk a little bit about the importance of this adventure model for how we understand tales in this part of the book? There's lots, right? There's like, there's a bunch at the end that kind of are these variations. So you talk about Miss Ren, the miraculous marriage at Dongting, the Li Hua tale, Shen Tu Cheng, Sun Ke. Are there any in particular that you find especially engaging that you'd want to maybe open up and introduce for listeners?
Yeah. They all have their great points, I would say. I think that what is maybe because some of them are better known than the others, I'll turn to some that are less or one that's a little less well known. I think that what this sort of this model for a of interaction with a stranger does is really to serve as a way of exploring for many for the reader sort of what the boundary between human and non-human is, and what the relationship between human and non-human should be. And so, you know, in the very simplest of these stories, you kind of have, well, you know, so the sort of the example that I start out with is that, you know, someone's walking along at night in Luoyang, and he encounters this, I think it's a beautiful princess who invites him to go with her, and, you know, and her friends, there are you know, going off partying, and she feasts him. She sleeps with him, and then in the middle of the night, he wakes up and realizes that in fact he's in this tomb, and her body is next to him, and it's rotted and fetid, and, you know, he sort of barely manages to climb out of there, and dies a few days later. And so that, you know, in this sense, that's an earlier version, you have a very stark boundary between the human and the non-human. Well, she's a dead person, so she's human, but, you know, between the living human and the other, that once that boundary is crossed, it becomes deadly. But in the more complex versions of these stories or of this model, that you just mentioned, you know, we find more questioning of, well, is that boundary really that stark? Is it more possible for people or, you know, creatures on the other side of this boundary between the living human and the other to cross over into the human realm and really participate in human society? And so, one example is, you know, one of the examples that you just mentioned is the story of Shan Tucheng, and Shan Tucheng is also, you know, traveling at night, and this is a recurrent moment in these stories, that the moment of encounter is often created by travel, by the fact that you know, a human man is out of his element, away from home. He has to get somewhere else, and he gets lost, or it gets too late, and he can't get where he's going, and that, you know, creates a sort of a diversion. And so in Shan Tucheng, he's, you know, caught in a snowstorm at night. He takes refuge at this home of this rustic cottage where there's a, you know, a man and a woman and a young daughter. And then the daughter, though, is strikingly beautiful, and she sort of indirectly through using Shi Jing poems suggests that he could ask her to ask for her hand in marriage. So he does so, and her parents agree, and, you know, they're married, and then live very happily together for several years, and so I think that for readers, that, you know, this formula is common enough that at this point, you know, that they might be expecting something more complicated to happen, and so realize that, you know, this woman can't quite be what she seems, even though the revelation of who she really is delayed over the space of several years, a happy marriage, the birth of children. And then, you know, in this case, they return to the cottage where he had met her, and she, you know, she finds a tiger skin in the corner. She throws the tiger skin over her shoulders, and, you know, and turns into a tiger. Or at this point, we realize she turns back into a tiger, runs off into the woods, and is never seen again. But I think what's interesting here in terms of what's happening in the story is that she, well, one thing that it is, that it becomes her choice to resume her animal form, that she's not forced back into this this other form, not forced back onto the other side of this boundary that exists, but rather it, you know, she decides that, you know, being human is apparently not worth it. The other way that this is complicated is that when she's in human form, precisely that she does play the role of the human wife or the human woman so perfectly, and that she is shown to be able to, she performs all the tasks that a good human wife should and everything. She's also literate. She can compose poetry, and she does so seemingly better than her husband does. When she writes a poem to him, he doesn't understand. He doesn't catch on to the veiled hints that she may not be what he thinks she is, and so that, you know, in contrast to kind of that stark boundary that we see in so many of the simpler stories, a story like Shen Tu Cheng is really asking, in effect, what does it mean to be human? You know, what is it? Is it sort of biology, or is it mastery of certain kind of cultural norms? And, you know, at what point can we draw that boundary, or really can we draw that boundary? Is it possible for someone who is not human to nonetheless behave so humanly that it really, really doesn't matter? And then I think this, you know, goes back to the fact that it's also that it's her choice to decide not to be human, that she decides, fundamentally, it's she's the one who decides that fundamentally she's more tiger than human, and that she wants to go back to being a tiger. And so, you know, again, that perhaps even leads to questioning, you know, which is what it's really worth being a human, you know, if the tiger can have all of the pleasures of sort of human society and human culture, and then decide that they'd rather give it up and go back to being a tiger.
Thank you so much. So there's some super fascinating stuff going on in that chapter, and that's just one of many stories that you take us into that show the range of the uses and the kind of manipulation of the uses of this particular model. Now, the fourth chapter continues this by showing us a kind of progression in this formula. So this formula that took shape, as you put it, as a vehicle for lore and urban legend came to be used to challenge the assumptions of the formula itself, sort of in a way related to, but even more so than the example that you just gave us, and then became a vehicle for literary play, for contrivance and wit. And this is some fabulous stuff. So the tales that are in chapter four are also tales that take the form of this kind of strange encounter adventure story, but they call attention explicitly to their artificiality. And the chapter looks at two types of these tales. In one type of the tales, there's an unlikely configuration, as the chapter puts it, of people who are brought together in a gathering that's witnessed by the traveler. And those people could be mythological figures, they could be ghosts, they could be historical figures. And there's an example that you take us through called Wedding on Mount Song. There's also tales that are riddling tales, so tales with riddles and puns and wordplay, which are awesome. And you bring us into two examples. One of them is Tung Ting Jun, where a guy makes friends with a broom and a fly. And then there's a story called Night Weirdness at Dongyang. Okay, so these are super fascinating stories, and I would love it if you could kind of, is there one of the stories in here, either the wedding or Tung Ting Jun or the night weirdness, that you particularly like, that you'd like to maybe introduce for listeners, kind of in the spirit of explaining what's going on here with this riddling and this wordplay?
Right. I think that the most spectacular of the stories in this that I talk about in the chapter is really the what I translate as night weirdness at Dongyang. which is a story, you know, sort of in the same vein as the ones that I was just talking about, in the sense that a traveler is, a man is traveling late at night. He actually, just like Shun Tu Chung, he gets caught in a snowstorm and can't go further. In this case, he takes his, he takes refuge in a temple that he finds by the side of the road, and there's this, you know, old monk living there that offers him shelter, but, you know, says that unfortunately there's, you know, my fire went out, or there's no light, so he can't actually see anything, or he can only see very dimly by the light of the moon occasionally, but he is, you know, he's able to go inside and take shelter from the snowstorm. And then in the course of the night that he spends there, you know, as he's chatting with the monk, that then several other guests arrive, people who the monk at the temple, friends of the monk at the temple, who, you know, have come to pay him a visit on this snowy night. And so it sort of turns into this convivial gathering, as more and more guests arrive. And, you know, as is, as frequently happens in this story, these stories that are describing socializing, you know, the different figures are chatting, several of them compose poems, and they, you know, they generally have a very, very convivial night together. And then all of a sudden, you know, a nearby bell tolls dawn, and our human hero in the story has been having so much fun that he doesn't realize how time has passed. And then, you know, But with the tolling of dawn, all of the other figures fall silent, and, you know, and so this is the moment of realization that you know they weren't what they had seemed to be, and then, you know, in contrast to the other stories that I mentioned where there's something disguised as a woman, you know, all of these figures are disguised as men, but he realizes, you know, so they've had this sort of, it's become a social encounter, rather than a sexual encounter. But he then, you know, sort of in the course of leaving the temple, he's very bemused, but he sees, various animals, and he see there are hedgehogs, there's a donkey, and there's a cat, there's a dog, and so then and there's not an explicit connection made between any of the animals that our hero sees and the figures who he spent the night with, but the implication is that these animals have been the quote unquote people that he's been socializing with. And so, you know, and then with that realization, which again, you know, I think that the astute reader would probably have been clued into from the very beginning, you see, you know, you realize that all of their speech has been coded, that the in, for example, the, you know, and I give this example at some length in the book, that the donkey who is, you know, seems to be this kind of low level clerk, complaining about how he's been toiling away in the office for, you know, all his life and how exhausting he is, that he's really complaining about how he has been how hard the lot of a donkey owned by the government is, that's, you know, constantly lugging things around on the road and, you know, constantly beaten and forced to go forward. And so that in many of the figures of speech that seem very, very plausible as descriptions of what, you know, the travails of a of a low-level government official work just as well, literally, as a description of what, you know, of the donkey's travails. And so I think that what's just so remarkable about this story is the intricacy and the multiple levels on which this kind of this punning and wordplay takes place, so that it really is woven so deftly into the fabric of the story that we can read it sort of completely straight as a conversation among a bunch of men who happen to gather at a temple. While then, you know, the later realization that's not what they are, then it adds a whole new depth of understanding to their speech. And so, I mean, in many ways, it comes back to some of the same issues as I was just talking about with Shuntu Cheng, who marries the tiger, that, you know, you have these animals who demonstrate, you know, that they are totally conversant with all of these elements of human culture, that that there's an ox who, you know, he writes a poem about himself that's filled with these with references to canonical texts, to history, to human figures, and that again you can read as a human, you can read in the voice of a human speaker, but that then also makes sense, or make it perhaps a different sort of sense, it read in the voice of an ox. But it's an ox that knows all of this, you know, that knows all of this human culture, that knows, that's comfortable writing a regulated poem and cramming all of these historical references into it. And so again, it's, you know, perhaps in a much more playful way than something like Shuntu Cheng, but is again, you know, exploring that boundary between human and other, sort of on a philosophical level. But it's also just that the story itself is just such sheer fun, because, I mean, we don't know who wrote it, but it must have, you can sort of imagine the process of embedding all of these clues into the poetry and the speech of these animals, and waiting for the audience, the reader, to try to decipher them. And, you know, I think there are annotated editions of this story, and I don't know if it all has been deciphered, or if there are other sort of clues still, there are references that the annotators clearly don't get. And so, you know, it's sort of a puzzle that's been left for posterity, that hasn't fully been unraveled, or at least the unraveling is incomplete, at least for our time, whether or not contemporary readers would have gotten it more. So, I mean, I think that this just it really underscores also the sheer fun that writers were having with the tale form at this point as well.
Thank you so much. And so this chapter also, I think, is going to be of particular interest for readers and listeners who don't imagine themselves to be particularly interested in China, perhaps, per se, but are really interested in histories of and literatures of and with the non-human. There's a really, really interesting discussion in chapter 4 of things that sing, right? The sort of singing and talking of the non-human, of objects. And I think that's, I just wanted to mark that as being of perhaps particular interest for this broader field that's emerged of studies of and with the non-human. So chapters 5 and 6 look at changing attitudes toward authorship in tale texts of the 8th and 9th centuries. And because we're sort of coming to the end of our time, we won't have time to talk about all of the really important things that are happening here, but I'll just kind of briefly summarize and then ask you a quick question. So in chapter 5, we see that copiers of tales had some leeway regarding the extent to which they kept or changed details of the stories that they copied. And you give us three different examples, or three different kinds of ways that collectors engaged with the work of previous writers in terms of how they retold the tales. Some of them keep the wording and anecdotes, but omit the framing and the indication of authorship of the previous story. Some of them significantly change the story, but credit the original source. And some of them change the story and omit reference to the source. And you take us through examples of that and talk about the various ways that these sort of variations are important for how we understand authorship and textuality in this period. Now, Chapter 6 continues this analysis by focusing on the anthology Yiwenji, the only anthology of tales that's known to have been compiled in the Tang. And this chapter looks at the anthology as a way of getting at what you call the closing of texts and the increasing attention to tales as textual authored works in this period. So what I'd like to ask you is just to talk a little bit about that, and specifically, the chapter's arguing that a more textual and author-centered attitude emerges in the mid to late 9th century. So can you say a little bit about that and about why that's important for us to understand in order to understand the larger argument that the book is making?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing is that it... as you said, it really does mark a change in attitudes towards this material that, as you just mentioned, that sort of the norm at this point is, you know, just as with kind of just as many of the written tales that we have today are tied to oral storytelling, and that you know, things would get changed in the course of that storytelling, that one oral version of a tale would not be, or of a story would not be precisely the same as the next. You would change things, you would, you know, modify to suit your audience, or you would, if you were telling, you know, a story you'd heard from someone else, you would change it to make it the story that you want. And then also, if you then go and write down that story, you know, changes are sort of seamlessly introduced, that there's not this assumption of fidelity to a source. And so, you know, in the fifth chapter, then I, you know, make the point that this same fluidity applies also to written texts. And I think that that's something that remains the norm for the entire period that I cover in the story. And indeed, as you said, when we were talking about the introduction, beyond it, for the most part, these are not texts that, you know, any reader or any, you know, copyist felt, well, I must... I have to be absolutely faithful to what's on the page in front of me, but rather, you know, readers would feel free to draw upon things that they had read as well as things that they had heard if they, you know, were trying to if they decided to make their own collection of stories, and likewise, you know, even in copying something fairly intact, that a transcriber might feel free to make, you know, even rather considerable changes. But at the same time, I think, well, you know, one thing is that at the same time, we do have all of these texts, right? And we have so we have the evidence that they were being preserved, even if they were being changed in the preservation. And so then in this sixth chapter, I explore this idea that it is in the 9th century that we start seeing some readers, at least, seeing texts of these tales not just as material for, you know, sort of their own entertainment and reuse, but as integral texts that should be preserved more or less as they existed, so that instead of sort of rewriting and reframing a story, this anthologist Chen Han collected stories from many different writers, stories that had previously circulated independently, and put them together in an anthology. And I think that this is really significant, both in sort of the recognition of this tale form as something that was worth preserving in and it's a sort of a recognition that these materials have worth and have are something that deserve collection and preservation as a body, and in at the same time, you know, what it does is that it really it also to some extent starts to codify a genre in saying that these kind of disparate texts that had circulated without a context, by bringing them together, it suggests that, well, this is all the same kind of material. It forms a genre worth putting together and worth kind of reading as a collection. I think that act becomes, really significant in the way then that this material is perceived in later centuries, that especially, you know, even jumping ahead to to the 16th century, and then even more to the 20th century, when this material gets re-examined by May 4th intellectuals and really re-evaluated and assigned a new value as kind of this turning point in the history of Chinese narrative writing, that they are, like Lu Xun and other May 4th writers are very much looking back at the picture of the tale that Chan Han, the compiler of this anthology, gives us, and really making that their starting point. So it's had an enormous influence. I mean, there's sort of this canonization process that occurs in the 9th century through the act of this anthologist who we really know almost nothing else about, but that then becomes instrumental in the way that the material is perceived and interpreted in much, much more recent reevaluations of the history of Chinese literature. And I'm not sure if I answered your question at all.
You totally did. No, you totally. Thank you. And also, you gave us some really interesting ways to look ahead to, although we won't have time to talk about it, some of the work that's done in the conclusion, right, where you really take us into an argument for thinking about these tales as a corpus, and for thinking about some of the ways that Lu Xun understood what was happening in terms of tales in the Tang Dynasty, and how the study here both supports and also kind of complicates part of what he's saying. And also, you talk a little bit in the conclusion, about what happens next. So we won't have time to talk about that, but I just want to kind of mark that for listeners. So there's a lot going on in the conclusion as well. So, Sarah, we've come to the end of our hour, and there's a ton of material in the book that we haven't had a chance to talk about. But is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Let's see. Well, I guess just very quickly, to underscore the notion that I think that getting back to Lu Xun, that sort of the way that this material has been presented in 20th and even still in the 20th century presentations of this material is, you know, really seeing at it as the beginning of fiction in China. And so this notion of sort of the inventiveness and even the creative author who sits down and creates his story, that my work is, I think, very much a response to that, and that, you know, one of the central things that my reading of more material suggests is that really is, you know, it's a that what we're looking at is much, much more complicated. And so, you know, I guess I would just want to offer a counter to, you know, what one sort of hears in the standard history of Chinese literature course, saying that this is, you know, this material marks the beginning of fiction in China. I think that, you know, certainly that there are fictional elements, but that what's really important for us to keep in mind as, you know, as readers in our own time, is that that distinction between fact and fiction has not always been as controlling as we assume it is today. That it's really possible for it not to matter, and I think that's what we have in with this much of this medieval material, or late medieval material in particular.
Thank you. So now that the book is out, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I'm working most sort of on material that didn't make it into the book. And as much as I sort of hate to admit that and would like to be moving on to other things, but I see this book as in many ways preliminary, sort of an assessment of the material as a whole that then can provide the foundation for, you know, all sorts of future work, and not just by me, I hope, but, you know, at this point, including me. I think it does stand alone as a book, but that it also raises a lot of questions that I don't really have space to answer there. So right now I'm working on looking at a few mid and late 9th century tale collections to explore that question of, you know, what writers are doing when they do move further and kind of more consistently beyond the model of collecting interesting information and oddities, and towards you know, trying to form a more coherent collection that might carry the stamp of an individual writer. So, you know, what do writers do when they start to see this form of writing, the tale, or even more specifically, the tale collection, as potentially literally, literary, potentially a vehicle for a form, even of self-expression that would previously have been found more in poetry or prose. And I think so the stories that I'm looking at in this project are by and large, you know, not the ones that are the most acclaimed today, but I think it's where we see really the greatest innovation in sort of narrative writing at this time, so that they did demonstrate a real interest in experimenting with the ways in which these kinds of narratives are presented and constructed. So, you know, some of the stuff that I touch on very briefly in some of the chapters, you know, taking those threads and trying to follow them and see where they take me.
Well, that sounds awesome, too. So best of luck with that work. And thank you so much for talking with me about the book. It's really been a pleasure, and it's a fabulous book.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to do this.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.